Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Frank Reardon of Your Mother's Medicine Cabinet, brought to you by the fine folks out there at the Literary Underground, like Lynn Alexander, Frankie Metro, Paul Coleman Roberts, Michelle McDaniel, and all those guys. Tonight's guest is Dan Fonte, author of such books as Chump Change, Spitting Off Tall Buildings, Mooch, 86, and also a playwright and a poet of such books as Kissed by a Fat Waitress. It's an honor to have Dan on. Decided to skip the music tonight so we can have more time. And I think this is him, so we'll bring him on.
Hey,
hello,
Frank.
Dan?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You missed one thing, Frank.
What's that?
My new book is my memoir about my father and myself. It's called Fonte, a Memoir, a Family Legacy of Writing, Drinking, and Surviving. That's the new one.
Oh, yeah, that's the one I haven't read that I need to read. I've been reading so much of your books since last December. And I first got your, a couple years ago, Kissed by a Fat Waitress, and I really liked that one, but I've been... I went through a span where I couldn't really afford novels, and I was getting them again, and I first read Chump Change, and then it just went from there. I found them all to be just fantastic books. But so recently you went on a trip to Italy. How was that?
Well, actually, I was in, last month I was, for 3 weeks I was in Spain and France. I was in about 5-6 cities in France doing readings and book festivals and stuff like I sell pretty well in France.
That's great. Is it true that the Europeans seem to have a better hand on literature?
Well, it's kind of a trippy thing. I'm really a French writer. The first book you mentioned, Chump Change, which is the favorite of my novels, that was rejected by, I stopped counting at 40, but every American publisher for about a year and a half, and finally it was published in France, and in 2 weeks I sent a letter and the manuscript. 2 weeks later I got a check and a contract, so I'm a French writer, Frank.
That's not bad. There's a great lineage, like Céline and those guys came out of France.
Yeah, no, it's not bad at all. I don't mind the company, and my old man and Bukowski do pretty well over there too.
Yeah, that's speaking of those two guys, that's kind of how I discovered you in many ways. Like, I found Bukowski to be a good gateway drug into other writers, per se. And then I, of course, discovered your father. And reread some of his books recently, too.
Many people, that's a pathway for a lot of people. Most people get me through my dad, but a lot of people get me through Hank because Hank had a great influence on my work, as did a guy named Hubert Selby, who died here a few years ago. But Cubby was a great writer, and so that school of, I don't know, in England they call us the Brutalists. I'm not sure what name fits, but there's a school of fiction where, and my father was writing about it 70 years ago, where you tell the truth about what's in your heart, and that is, and you base your work upon that, and that that's the kind of book I've been writing for 25 years.
Yeah, I've do you think it was because I noticed that, I'll just use the word, the Brutalists got more popular, say, with, like, Bukowski, but your dad was doing it way before, and people like Hampson and those guys. Do you think it's just that your dad wasn't as successful because he was ahead of his time back then?
Well, remember something. That literary canon is called modern fiction, and if you flash forward to the last 25, 30 years to postmodern fiction, my dad was writing, modern fiction, you have ambition and you're a poor kid and you grow up and you you become the star pitcher on the baseball team and you find the girl, and it's, you know, it's kind of like that. It's kind of the MGM ending for, but in postmodern work, which a lot of my father's work was, Ask the Dust is really postmodern, and then his book, The Road to Los Angeles, is, man, that's a very postmodern book. So he broke traction with that school, although he never wanted The Road to Los Angeles published because it his publisher told him it was too perverse, but it would fit right in today, and it was published, I don't know, probably 15, 20 years ago, and it's a great book. But postmodern fiction, you can write about whatever you want. And you can say whatever you want. In my father's day, you could not do that, and so it was different. And until the Beats, literature really didn't begin to change in America, you know.
Yeah, he was. I don't know, when I first read him, which was Ask the Dust, it blew my mind in many ways, because especially his use in sentences, and when he's like up in that rooming house, and I don't know. He was just fantastic. But you, in your Kissed by the Fat Waitress book, there's a poem that you wrote for him called Here You Go, Pop. This one's for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and in the part where you were reading, like, 1933 was a bad year, and I like how you said that he, read this hot shot, and, like, was he, like, really like that? He just didn't give a shit what the other people thought. I mean, that's kind of what I got from the poem.
You know, my dad was sensitive to his audience, but he was a very difficult guy, Frank. He was, there's a famous movie called The Cat People, and my dad was on the set, and Val Lewton, who was the guy that directed it, was a real prick, and he was kind of nasty to everybody. And he said something about my father's dialogue, and in front of 50 people on the set, my father punched him in the nose and knocked him down. You know, so I guess you'd call it feisty. He just wouldn't take any crap from anybody, and it really, of course, it's an admirable characteristic. When you're not in the room and you're discussing it over drinks at Musso's, but in truth, it cost him a lot of work, and it cost him a lot of friendships too, because he told people exactly what he thought of them, and a lot of times it wasn't very nice.
So, and also in the poem, it talks about how, you were saying that you thought you were a genius in the past, how you, like, went to coffee shops, would it be, like, Kerouac wannabes and stuff like that. Was it him or your father or other people that helped you realize and find your own truth? Or was that just something that you, since you started late, had to discover on your own?
You know, it's a good question. I wasn't sure if I had anything to say as a writer. I was a drunk for, you know, over 20 years and a hustler. I owned a limousine company here in town, and I used to sell people they didn't want, stuff they didn't want over the phone, and I did pretty well at that. And then, but I just, you know, I just bottomed out, in the late 80s, and so I was broke, and I didn't have broke and crazy and suicidal, and I didn't even have gas money, and so I found I was staying in the back bedroom of my mom's house, and I found his typewriter, and I found half a ream of yellow typing paper that he had written his last book with, that typewriter, using that paper. And I sat down and I started to type, and about 8 months later I had a novel. You know, I had no idea I was going to write anything, but it just kept pouring out of me, and it was a kind of a therapy to not blow my brains out. So and it was Chump Change. So who knows what the motive for that was, or what the circumstances, how the planets lined up. It just happened, and I'm grateful because I haven't stopped writing since. You know.
Yeah, that's also in the book, which is probably my favorite poem in the book. If you have it around and you could read it, that'd be swell. If not, I understand. But it's called "Mom at 89," the very first poem.
Oh, that's a terrific poem. Hang on a second. I've got it on my computer, I think. Hang on.
Okay.
Let's see.
Well, Dan's looking for that in a little bit. I see a couple people online in a little bit. I'll take callers in a little bit, so just be patient.
Well, trying to call that poem up, and not sure why I can't get it. Open. Okay, let me,
well, that's
let
fine
me.
If you can't get it. Okay.
But I like the poem, so... Hang on a second. I'm going to get it. Let's see. Well, for whatever reason, I can't find it right now. I
That's
love
fine.
It. Why don't you read it?
Oh, okay. It says, today at the home, I read her some of my new stuff. While she squinted at me, straining to hear, my savvy mouth sputtering out chainsaw syllables beneath those perfect and unspoiled steel gray eyes, this ancient ex-editor who's read more and knows more about writing and poetry than I'll ever hope to know. Five minutes into it, looking up, I said, well, what do you think? She seemed distracted. 10,000 brow wrinkles came, flattened out, then returned. Do you still have that phone sales job? She said, "No, Ma, I don't. I have a day gig. I don't have a day gig anymore. Writing is all I do. Help, get one for Christ's sake," she said, "and help me out. I need to use the bathroom." That just like kind of sort of cracks me up because she just like was this the manuscript or these the poems from in here that you let her read in this book or just other ones?
No, that was one that I wrote just prior to her death. Let me read one that I'm just opening my book, A Gin Pissing Raw Meat Dual Carburetor V8 Son of a Bitch from Los Angeles. This is another one of kind of that vein. It goes like this. I bought a car today, my old one, the one that had carried me through brokenness and depression and attempted suicide for years, complaining but faithful as a wet, stinking old dog that would never give up or never go home, finally sprung an oil leak to go with the struts and the master cylinder and the radiator that needed immediate attention 18 months ago. The smell of gasoline was making my passengers choke at every stoplight, and my new wife decreed that she would never ride in the beast again. So we stopped at a used car lot, and I found a shining 3-year-old red one. I always buy red whenever possible. And I said goodbye, and the salesman watched me as I put my hand on her trunk and patted her. Goodbye, old car, I said. You saved my ass over and over and never quit on me. Through the showroom window, she was smiling, approving my happy cosigner. It was then that I grasped an immutable truth. Wives come and go, but a good used car is a treasure.
It's all your writing is just straight to the gut, and I really appreciate that about your writing. And it's very real to me. It's like the one I just read to you, where and it just makes me think of like you talking about your dad and reading your stuff, and somewhat knowing you from reading it, that there must have been times where your mother wanted to knock your two heads together.
Well,
I think.
When I finished Chump Change, the manuscript, she didn't know what I was doing, and I was just in the, she had a big house out in Malibu, and I was in one of the back bedrooms, and you know, she thought I was watching porn or something, and then I was typing, you know, and so I brought her the manuscript, and she said, "Oh, Jesus Christ." She said, "You're a writer?" I said, "Yeah, Ma, I'm a writer." She said, "I don't want another one in my house. Get out." And then about a month later, I had sent the manuscript off to a guy my dad knew, a guy in the film business who knew some people in publishing. And I told my mother, and she said, "Why'd you do that? That guy's a preposterous, you know, a fool. He's just, why did you, that's an insult to me." And I said, "What are you talking about, Mom? I'm trying to get the book published." She said, "Will you give it to me?" So I gave her the manuscript. My mother was a terrific, she edited word for word and retyped the goddamn manuscript completely. And then she gave it back to me. So she was ambivalent, I guess you could say. She wouldn't, and God bless her, you know, she said, "You know, you're many things, but what your best quality is your stubbornness. You don't give up." And she was right. I don't give up, you know. So
that must have been, you know, while you were writing that book, Chump Change, which I want to get into in a minute here, is you had like a lot of good foundation in a way, I suppose, with your parents, your mom reading the way she did, your dad being a writer the way he was. Must have, of course, that, you know, Italian stubbornness, which I grew up around myself, so.
But you know it, then. you know, it. My mom read 4 or 5 books a week all her life, and she was a remarkable person, and she was, you know, she was an editor, and when she was 20 years old, she was editing a magazine, and then she met my father, and she became his wife, and she had many different pastimes, but my father was this kind of. And she was she was not outspoken. She was extremely well educated, and very articulate. But she wasn't outspoken. My father, of course, was. He was, so living with the two of them, it was like living with Picasso. He was banging furniture and screaming into the phone, and you know, chasing dogs down the street. And he was just a nut. And my mother was this more sedate, intellectual type, so it was quite an interesting combination, and there were 4 of us, so you know, they had all they could, or she had all she could handle, and so she set her own needs as a person aside in favor of my dad, which was, you know, kind of the relationship convention of the 40s and 50s, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I got you. And that's now the first novel I read of yours was Chump Change, and there was a lot of emotion, but yet there was a lot of laughter in a way, because in many ways you can extreme, if you who had troubles like myself with alcohol or things like that, you can kind of relate to this. The Bruno character, which I think is a fantastic character. I mean, truthful.
Thank you.
But
thank you.
Fantastic. And I would have to say, though, that my favorite, and I'm sure there's other people who have read it. If not, you should. But my favorite character in many ways in there was your dog, was your father's dog. And I don't want to. Go ahead.
That, you know, when you write a book that's as dark and subject matter as Chump Change, you know, it's awfully important to counterbalance that darkness with humor and the humor of this horrible relationship my character had with his father's dog. And so the dog balanced it out and gave some humor to an otherwise, you know, a very Celine-like a plot, you know.
Yeah, he was the poor thing, or if I remember correctly, you were feeding him beer and Percocet or something, because he was hurt or sick. Was that the same dog that's in that famous picture of your dad, or is that just a different dog altogether?
Oh, that's the same.
Like, you know,
that's the same. Oh. Yeah. He died.
And it was,
He died a different way. I took some literary liberty with that, but he was a. My father really loved that dog and had a passion for him, and so it was. It's only just that Rocco should have been a main character in that book. You know, I love that, and it was. I was going through a kind of madness when I wrote that book that only writing a manuscript would redeem. I was really on the edge because I had quit drugs and alcohol, and all of a sudden my life came crashing in around me, and I had I didn't have a pot to piss in, and I just was typing, and I was typing to save my sanity, and what came out of it was Chump Change. So I'm at least I gave some form to the madness,
Exactly, and I just this might be kind of, I don't want to give too much away of the book for those who didn't read it, but was there in many ways like a way for you to connect to your dad with that dog within that book, because he was around you watching the Bruno character constantly screw up and spend days.
But the book was, of course, is an allegory because, through that dog, I saved the character Bruno redeems his relationship with his father by coming to love the dog. He gets to a resolution in his love for his father. So, but interestingly enough, the character of the hooker, the 15-year-old hooker, is a real character. She was a girl I knew in Hollywood.
Do you have that book? Are you able to read a little of it, or is that too much? Or?
Yeah, sure. Let's see what I can read for you. Let's try this. It was still dark when I opened my eyes again, looking. This is page 52 of the current edition of Chump Change. It was still dark when I opened my eyes again, looking at the lighted digital clock on the nightstand. I could see over 3 hours had passed. Down the hill, I heard the water. Down the hall, I heard the water in the shower running, and I knew Fabrizio was awake, too. I dressed in the blackened bedroom, not wanting to see myself in the mirror, fumbling into my clothes. In this smogless, clear Malibu night, the light from a big, powerful full moon surprised me with its brightness and caused me to walk to the window. Outside, I saw Rocco once again near the back porch steps. He was where I had left him hours before, still facing the door with the gopher's body between his forelegs, waiting for the approval of his master who would never return. After taking a piss, I made my way down the hall toward the kitchen. The door to my father's study was closed. I paused. Nobody ever entered except with the old man's permission. Swinging the door open in the dark room, I waited for his demons to leap upon me. None did, so I hit the light switch and let the incandescent light from the desk lamp assault the walls. The room was unchanged from the last time I'd entered it to talk with my old man 7 years before. The furniture was old, sturdy office stuff, heavy dark oak and mahogany with fat, solid legs. Each piece had been picked from one of the used furniture stores on Western Avenue. On the far wall, above a bookcase, was a large, grimy, old framed photo of H.L. Mencken, his hair parted severely down the middle and his shirt collar heavily starched. The great iconoclast was scowling. The books on the shelf behind his writing table were the important ones, the sacred stuff. Unlike the other novels in the room, they never moved except to get reread. There was all of Knute Hampson, all of Sherwood Anderson, all of Jack London. In Dante's house, only great literature, art, and great writers got talked about. Men of accomplishment, like himself. Men to be feared and reckoned with. Other discussions were unimportant. The rest of the books in the room that weren't on shelves were in stacks on the floor. Most of them were by good writers, but Dante never actually read them. He was a skimmer, completely impatient, always unimpressed. He'd read a whole book that way, a few paragraphs at a time. He'd read the first sentence of each paragraph, then move on. From the bookcase behind his writing table, I pulled down a copy of Knute Hampson's Hunger. The book, my father used to say, caused him to become a writer. I held it in my hand and flipped through the old pages. Somewhere in the middle, I discovered a sheet of typing bond that had been folded in quarters. It looked to have been used as a bookmark. It was yellow from age at the top, where it had been exposed to the air. I unfolded the makeshift bookmark and immediately recognized the handwriting as my father's. But over and over, the signature written was Knute Hampson. Knute Hampson, Knute Hampson, a paper filled to the bottom of the page. The electricity jolted me because I'd done the same thing 100 times, filling legal tablets with E.E. Cummings signatures. The old man and I had things in common after all. I refolded the paper and stuck it in my pocket that put the book away. Leaving the room, I flipped the wall switch and returned everything to the darkness. There you go.
That's fantastic. I love that part in the book myself. I'm glad that you read that one. That's just a fantastic book. And the second one I read of yours was Mooch. And was this right around in real life when this book happened? I mean, I don't know the years or anything, but was that your did you end up sticking out AA and stuff like that right around that time in real life?
It was that was my second novel. That's really a fine novel because it had to do with I was a telemarketer for several years and I made a lot of money on the phone. I mean a lot of money and I you know I just lied to people. A few years ago, I sat down and realized. I did that job, I spoke to 100 people a day for 5 days, and I did it for 5 years. That's 60,000 people, I think. I lied to every one of them. I would say whatever it took to make the sale, you know. And so that was and I worked for a guy who was obsessed, madman, who... but he made people a lot of money, and we were selling computer supplies, you know, in the days when computers were just getting started, and it was just wide open. So, and there was, I did get to a place in the company where I was managing some people, and then I met this woman who was the hottest thing I had ever seen. She was Mexican and Persian, and she had bright blue eyes and long black hair, and she was just stunning. She's about 23, and I had to have her, and it was really the dance of death because she had no more interest in me, but she was interested in nice things and money, and I had a fast car and a house at the beach, and that's how we got along, and it was, you know, so it's the story of that relationship, you know, and it's, for the most part, it's a true story. I mean, it didn't end well, but she was just this madness. She was a drug. I couldn't let it alone, and so she dragged me face down for about a year and a half, you know, and they say there are no victims, they're only volunteers. Well, you know, I learned my lesson, I'll tell you that. But so that's that book. It's about a really. Oh, and in that book, there's a part in that book that is a true story. My father used to be friends with William Faulkner, and there's a scene in Mooch that was actually true. My father once came to Faulkner's bungalow in Hollywood to get him to go to the studio, and he was with another guy, Faulkner's assistant, and Faulkner was drunk, and his wife, Estelle, was naked on the bed in their bungalow, dancing up and down, drinking and screaming and throwing stuff at her husband, and Faulkner was just, he was drunk too, and they had to get him to the studio, and she said, my dad and his friend subdued Faulkner and subdued her, and then she jumped up on the bed and she poured whiskey on the mattress and she said, "You leave this house, you little shit, and I'll burn it to the ground." And Faulkner said, "You wouldn't do a thing like that." And she lit it up and then she burned the house down. And so there's a scene in Mooch that is right out of that. I have my character Jimmy doing it, but it's right out of that actual scene between Faulkner and his wife Estelle. You know.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book, and there was that, was your boss really like that? Like, he was kind of like a ball buster in a way, but he was also helping you out in the same...
He was a...
In the same part.
I write about him, there's a whole chapter in my memoir about him, Frank. He's really a remarkable man. He hired recovering addicts and alcoholics, and he built an empire, a business. I mean, the man's quite wealthy today, and he just did it because in AA they said, you know, they said, give it away. You know, you got to give it away to keep it. So you got to help other people. So he brought all these, I mean, people right out of recovery home, people living in their cars were on the phone sitting next to me. You know, they hadn't washed in 2 weeks, you know, but he saved their lives. And so he's a remarkable guy, you know, remarkable man.
That's great. We got a caller who wants to ask you something, if that's all right.
Sure, sure.
All right. 412, your area code, you're on.
Well, you know what, I won't ask anything. I know you only have a couple minutes left. I just, you know, wanted to say that this has been a wonderful interview, and I have to tell you that Frank he's pretty much gotten me interested in your writing, and it's just a wonderful opportunity to hear you interviewed on the show. I kind of credit Frank with you know, opening my eyes to a lot of different kinds of writers lately. And, it's just that's just a quick comment, really. And, you know, I know you only have a couple minutes left, but I just wanted to thank you for doing the interview and for being on the show. It's been very interesting, wonderful.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, how does a writer, you know, with media and how does a writer of my kind get press or interest in his work? It's through shows like this, so I'm very grateful, and I hope you read Chump Change and Mooch. I think you won't be bored, I'll tell you that.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that Frank is, you know, why he puts these shows together, and why, you know, I think word of mouth, and I think speaking to the writers and the things that you're passionate about and sharing that with other people, I think really word of mouth is just really the way to go in our circles. You know, it's, you know.
I have to agree. The sales of my books, you know, I'm not on any bestseller list, but the word of mouth on my stuff, I sell very decently, and it's only because of, you know, people like you and Frank who, you know, when you've got a great chocolate chip cookie or you found a great restaurant, you recommend it to your friends, and you know, I just appreciate it. So thank you very much.
Right. No, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, and I will hang up and let you guys talk a little more. I know you have about 15 minutes left, so thank you and good night.
Good night to you. Thank you.
I read an interview with you once where you like going to bookstores to see if your dad's books are there, and it's funny thing is not with just your dad. I look for people that I like too, like your dad, or I look for Celine or stuff like that, and I don't see it, but there's plenty of that Nora Roberts crap.
You know, the bestseller table, you've got to look in the back shelves for for my stuff, you know, thank God for Amazon, because, you know, if, although my memoir is the new book is doing pretty well, and I mean pretty well, I mean, you know, compared to what I normally sell, you know, and it's, a, you know, it got a great review in the LA Times, but, you know, it just, it's, it, Frank, it's a, it, you know, if you're a writer in 2012, you know, if you meet somebody at a social event and you say you're a writer and they say, oh, yeah, no, I understand, but what do you do for work? And really, you know, that's, you know, you better believe in what you do and you better love what you do, because, and I've been at this, you know, I've been at this quite a while now, and it's what gives me juice. It's what keeps me getting up in the morning. I you know, I love what I do. It's a gift, you know. So, and I'm glad, you know, I'm grateful for my readers.
Yeah, this source, I was reading an interview tonight, actually, a little bit, and there was someone asked you a question about, what do you think of as a professional thing? And you said something like, if they don't mind 20 unpublished books and their woman calling them a chump and a loser. And I've only been doing it 7 years. I started later in life like you, 7 or 10 years, and I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. No, you,
yeah.
But it doesn't mean, you know, it's and I can testify to you and the people that are listening. I just, you know, I was in France and Spain for 3 weeks, and there are readers over there, and you know, I probably signed 500 books at one book festival. You know, I've got, I don't know, half a dozen books published in France right now, and they're all on the shelves, and people read. It's we're just, you know, we're a kind of an interesting intersection in this country where, you know, and I think the tough economic, my wife tells me that the economic times are going to make Bruno a star, because people are going to start to look at their own lives, you know, when they come and get the house and one of the jobs is gone between the mom and the dad. People are going to start having the problems I had, and eventually I hope they're going to start reading books again, because they're going to be looking for answers, and the answers aren't at McDonald's, you know, you know, and there's some great literature. There's some wonderful contemporary. I was in France with a guy named Willie Vlauten, and Willie is, written a couple of books, and he tours. He's got his own band. He's a terrific writer. You know, your audience, his name is Willie, Vlautin, just a terrific writer. So there, and he's a young guy. So there are really good writers out there. They just, you know, we sell 3,000 or 4,000 books, and we, you know, and we don't quit our day job, and we just, you know, we show up every day and we type, you know.
Do you think a lot of that America versus Europe thing, I mean, I've never been there, but do you think it's the attention span of Americans now with the TV and the video games and the text messaging that has made writing, reading and buying books not as easy?
I'm no sociologist, but I can just tell you that this is a woman I met over there who was a combat photographer, this French, little French woman in her 30s, about very pretty with long dark hair, had spent 6 years as a combat photographer, and she went to college here, and she's fluent in English, and she said, no, I'll never go back to America. And I said, why? And she said, it's just the intensity of the society and the fear. It's just Americans are they're just counterintuitive. She said it's a hard culture because there's so much anger, and she said I need a slower way of life. I need to be able to walk to the grocer and pet my dog and go to, you know, walk out in the countryside. And I, you know, I don't get it, but because I'm, you know, I'm born and raised in Los Angeles, but, and you know, I'm an American, but that's kind of the view of many Europeans have of Americans now. I mean, the ones that are not jealous of you know, our money, you know.
And I would have to say that I agree with what your wife said because about the Bruno Dante character, because when I first started reading it, it's more modern than, say, like Chinaski or the other people that were around in the 50s or so. It's definitely more modern and geared towards what is, in a way, going on now when a lot of us, like myself or something, has struggled with alcohol or struggled with numerous different jobs. He's definitely...
It's very contemporary when the wife or the husband is busted out and the job is gone and they, you know, and they start, going to the bar or coming home with a fifth of Old Crow and trying to, you know, lull themselves to sleep. We're in a culture, where there's I lost my home a year and a half ago in Arizona. We had moved to Arizona, and I couldn't afford it. The price was in half of what the house is worth, and the payments were still huge, and I just had to give it up. And many Americans, there are 22 million Americans in wearing my boots, you know, so... Yeah, Bruno, and the other thing, when you brought that up, if to your listeners, if you read Ask the Dust, which was written in 1937 and published in 39, and you take away the fact that coffee is a nickel and a loaf of bread is a nickel, it is probably one of the most contemporary novels you'll ever read. It's about a guy who's struggling to find himself in a new place, and he falls in. It's just he's an artist. It's a timeless story, and I think Chump Change and Mooch are like that too, you know.
Yeah, I always try to recommend when people ask me what they're looking for, and yours and your dad's books I've been recommending quite a bit lately, and I've been rereading your dad. I hadn't read your dad in about, you know, like 3 or 4 years, and you know, sometimes I like to reread certain authors to see if I get a different perspective, and I've been reread Ask the Dust last month, and it was, I mean, I'd find more in it each time that I read it, so I probably read it a couple of times, but, you know, we're down to here the last 3 minutes here, and is there any way that listeners can get your books besides, like, an Amazon, or?
That bookstore on Vermont Avenue, I'll tell you who's got Book Soup has them, and on Sunset Boulevard has my books, and then, why can't I think, Skylight Books on Vermont in L.A. has my books as well, and then if you go to any connection on the internet other than Amazon that sells books, you can get my books there too, you know. So that's where I mostly where most of my audience comes from, where most of my book sales come from, because there's only 2 independent bookstores left in Los Angeles, Frank, for God's sake.
Damn. And can they also buy books off of the danfonte.net website?
My website will refer you to other bookstores that carry my titles, and you can get them that way. And when you go into a bookstore, if you go into a Barnes & Noble, ask them to carry my books. That's the biggest thing you can do for me. Ask the guy behind the counter, I don't see any Dan Fonte here. Will you buy some Dan Fonte, you know, and that'd be great.
You're also in the latest issue of Epic Rights Press, True Killer Inc. There was something new in there too.
I'm on I've just finished an interview for Savage Kick, which is online there in Great Britain, and then I have a fan club that I didn't start, Frank. It's on Facebook. So and that's got videos, and the woman who runs it is a great friend of mine. Her name is Christina. So on my Dan Fonte Facebook fan club, there's articles about me and all kinds of other stuff that my friend Christina puts up there.
Well, it was we're down. The robotic lady's letting me know it's time to go. But it was wonderful having you on, and I thank you for taking the time.
Hey, Frank, thank you so much, and thank you for your recognition of my dad's work and mine. It's a real pleasure for me. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Bye.